Hey guys, today on the podcast, I'm talking with journalist and author Florence Williams about her latest book, Heartbreak. As it turns out, heartbreak is real, but you probably already knew that. But it has real and lasting effects on your body. This is a fascinating conversation about what heartbreak can do and how you can get over it.
Pull up a chair and buckle up. It's the Original Strength Podcast.
So Florence, this is the anniversary of your third book, Heartbreak.
It's just been out for 1 year. So the paperback came out last week.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Oh, that's a nice cover.
Thank you.
So we'll start here. Why did you decide to write a book about heartbreak?
Yes, good question. This was my third book, and my other two are loosely written in the first person, even though they're science books. So it's just a sort of a natural way I write, which is that if I have a question about something in my own life, that will kind of direct the research and it ends up being a book. And it's just, this time around, it was a little more personal. So what happened was I had been married for 25 years and the marriage went south and wasn't sort of my choice to end it. So there was a lot of grief and a lot of anxiety and fear. I had been with my partner actually for 32 years, even though the marriage was for 25. And I met him when I was 18.
Wow.
So, it was just a super dramatic life quake, but it was also confusing to me because I had never experienced it before. And I felt like my body became involved, in this emotional kind of crisis where I felt like I wasn't sleeping and I lost a ton of weight and I actually started getting sick. And so the science journalist in me just really wanted to investigate that and find out what was happening, what was going on, and what could I do to try to feel better. Eventually it became clear to me that there was a book here because I was uncovering so much stuff that I hadn't heard of before.
Awesome. Not awesome about how it came to be, but but in the end, awesome. So is there a way to define heartbreak? Like, is it just sadness? Is it loss? Is it both? Is it like, what is it?
Yeah, I think of heartbreak as something that happens when there has been a loss of a deep bond of attachment. So it can be, over the death of someone you love. It can be over something like a divorce. It can also be, I think, over a landscape. We have these deep bonds of attachment to places where we grow up, for example. We're seeing a lot of collective heartbreak, in the wake of these like climate-related fires and storms. When there's an act of violence in your community, there's a kind of collective heartbreak that can go on there as well. When a pet dies. I define it actually fairly broadly. It's not just about a romantic breakup.
And you kind of alluded to this with your own story, what are some possible health side effects of going through heartbreak?
Yeah, so it ends up being a fairly involved question because, what happens to our human brains is that we're really wired to be attached. And so when we lose someone, we're very close to, our nervous system responds as though we're in a state of threat. We have throughout our evolutionary history found so much safety in numbers. And when we live with someone, for example, a romantic partner, our bodies really co-regulate. We end up having really similar cortisol drops and rises during the day. Our gamma waves in our brains align when we're talking to each other. We end up having kind of similar respiration rates and heart rates at night. So we become in some ways very integrated, in terms of our nervous system with this person. And when they're suddenly no longer there, our bodies kind of freak out. And so we pump out more inflammation because we're kind of expecting that we are more vulnerable now. Maybe we'll be attacked now because, you know, we've been, our bodies kind of feel like we've been abandoned in the jungle. So that's something that happens in rejection. It happens, you know, when you've been kind of kicked out of your clan, or when you've lost your primary safety and attachment partner. So it's basically a kind of prolonged anxiety and fear response, but layered in with things like rejection and grief and betrayal. So like it's very multi-layered. And we know that people who go through divorce are 26% more likely to die young. They're 23% more likely to suffer from chronic disease. They're more likely to feel depressed and anxious, and they're more likely to feel lonely, which we know also contributes to chronic disease. So it's a serious matter. You know, we need to take heartbreak very seriously, and we need to learn what we can about how to get better.
So I was just about to ask you, because, you know, when I was a child, you would hear that somebody died of a broken heart.
Yeah.
So that is, you, I guess you pretty much can die of a broken heart.
Yeah, we tend to think of heartbreak as like a metaphor, but it actually can be literal. There's actually a condition called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which can happen as a consequence of a big emotional blow or another kind of stressful event, in which our immune cells are putting out so much, and our nervous system is putting out so many stress hormones like noradrenaline, norepinephrine, that these stress hormones kind of land on our heart cells and stun one of the ventricles of our heart, the left ventricle, so that it balloons out and it can't pump efficiently. So people actually do go into a kind of cardiac arrest after these big emotional blows sometimes. It's pretty rare, but it actually accounts for probably about 7% of all hospital admissions for heart failure. And it does have about a 5% fatality rate. We can increase your risk of heart disease later on. There was a physician, Sir William Osler, and I think it was around 1905, he said, the tragedies of life are largely arterial. Huh. Our bodies really sense our grief and our social state. And it's very fascinating. We also know that, you know, when one partner dies in a long-term couple, the other one has a greatly increased risk of death in the 6 to 12 months following that.
Wow. It's kind of weird. Like you said, we're wired for attachment. And then like, you know, in some religious traditions, like suffering or attachment leads to suffering. So basically we're wired to suffer.
We are. We're wired to suffer. Our brains are wired for heartbreak. There is an adaptive quality to that. You know, when we feel those losses so acutely, we're likely to try to prevent them. You know, we are empathetic about not wanting to cause a lot of hurt and pain in people we love. And sometimes, in some cases, you know, and we know that in some mammals, when there are some, for example, voles tend to mate for life in a monogamous way. And if one vole disappears, the one who's left behind will be so freaked out that, you know, that remaining vole is driven to find their partner, to wait for them, to hope they come back, you know? And so that's an adaptive response because it's better for the propagation of the species if we do wait around for our partner to come back. Unfortunately, you know, that's not the way it often works out. Yeah, especially in these human times.
So do voles mate for life because they're blind and they can't see each other?
Well, there's a number of different kinds of prairie voles.
It was a stupid voles. Joke.
Oh, gotcha. Because they're blind. I mean, like love is blind.
Right. It was a very bad joke. So
I get it.
So it almost sounds like heartbreak itself is almost like a disease itself that has a
you know, because it causes dis-ease in the body systemically in a number of ways.
It does. There was one scientist who told me that heartbreak is one of the hidden landmines of human existence.
Wow.
Because it does cause very consequential changes in our immune system. And literally our cells are sort of listening for loneliness. And when it happens, they change their genetic response. They change their transcription factors. Different genes get expressed, you know, that are sort of designed to help us fight, you know, being preyed upon by somebody or something or some wild animal. But if you're heartbroken or lonely for, you know, months and years, that chronic inflammation is really a recipe for death, unfortunately.
So you just mentioned months and years as a possibility. So I guess time doesn't necessarily heal heartbreak, or is that your, or does it? And you just, it just depends on the person how long it is, or are there other ways that you can help accelerate the healing or recovery from heartbreak?
Yeah. I mean, there are complicated answers to all of those pieces. It is different for different people, how long it takes to get over it. But we know on average, and I think this is sort of shocking, on average for divorce, it takes 4 years for your body to return to baseline. That's a really long time.
That's a long time.
It's a long time. I think there are ways you can speed that up. And of course, there are some people who are heartbroken for decades. And really, they're the ones probably driving those statistics in terms of early death and chronic disease. But I do think if you can speed it up a little bit, it's definitely worth doing for your health.
So as an attempt to segue, you wrote an amazing book called The Nature Fix.
Thank you.
It's great. Could nature be a way to fix or help mend a broken heart?
I do believe that nature can be helpful if we are feeling lonely, if we are feeling grief. So many things that make us sad. Yes, being in nature is an absolute balm for a lot of people, as in BALM. I do believe that, but I do not think, at least in my experience, it was not the magic bullet that suddenly made me feel better. I spent 30 days in the wilderness, you know, in an attempt to kind of feel better and get over my heartbreak. And I really thought that it would work. I thought I would feel great after 30 days. And I still did it. I still was dealing with a lot of grief and a lot of anxiety and still fear for my future and all that. But I worked with a scientist at UCLA and we looked at my blood cells in my immune system to find out, you know, or we looked at cells in my immune system to find out if they were still putting out markers of inflammation, and they were after the wilderness trip. So the wilderness trip did not heal my cells and unfortunately did not heal my heart, but it was part, absolutely part of the process of just learning to feel a little bit less stressed out, learning to access more a sense of calm, you know, gaining some joy in my daily life. I eventually kind of migrated from, you know, trying to be in the wilderness for 30 days to just trying to enjoy being outside a little bit every day, you know, sort of microdosing nature, microdosing awe. And I think that was incredibly helpful. And that's by science as well.
I had the sense that we're also wired from your book that we are very much wired to be out in nature. Like our body craves it.
Our bodies do crave it. And our perceptual systems are, you know, evolved outside. So when we are reading with our eyes, when we're scanning a natural landscape, you know, on some sort of subconscious level, we feel comfortable with what we're seeing because we can understand it. It's like coherent to us. Oh, there's a lake, there's a tree, there's a bird. Whereas if you're crossing a city intersection or something, like a traffic circle in Washington, D.C., where I lived for 10 years, that doesn't feel comfortable to us. You know, it feels overwhelming. There's too much stimulation. We have to kind of work to block stuff out. If we're listening to the radio while we're driving through that intersection, we can't process anything we just heard. So our bodies are just naturally more at home, you know, in the places where our eyes and our ears and our nose and everything else evolve outside.
Yeah, I had a interesting experience with this. I guess it was August, both of my children moved out to go to college. My first time since they've been alive that my house was without them. And it felt it felt very heavy and sad, right? So for some reason, I just walked out on the back porch, and in my backyard, there's like 30 feet from my back porch is a fence with a cow pasture. And just sitting out there watching the cows eat grass somehow just made me feel so much better. I can't explain it other than it made things lighter.
It makes things lighter. I think part of what's going on there is you kind of feel like you're part of a larger world than just the world inside your head, which is reminding you how sad you are. You know, you feel more connected to things around you, and you're reminded, right, that life goes on, that there are seasons and there are cycles, and that everything changes. And it's very reassuring, and it does do wonders for things like your stress hormones and you know, your just sense of peace. All that stuff really changes even after just 15, 20, 30 minutes of looking at the cows.
Yes, it was amazing. Totally helped me walk that off, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and walking it off is a literal thing too. You know, we know that bilateral motion, right, can really help kind of release some stress from traumatic memories, for example.
Absolutely. It's great for the brain, the nervous system, everything. But your book, The Nature Fix, actually got me thinking, well, walking is, yes, the motion itself is the miracle movement that we're designed to do. Yes. But then it had me wondering, is walking really also so powerful? Because most people, when they go take a walk, they're not taking a walk inside, they're taking a walk outside. And so then I thought, well, what if it's a 1-2 punch?
You know, I mean, increasingly, I mean, right, people do have, you know, machines and treadmills and indoor tracks and things like that. But there have been scientific studies showing that when people walk 3 miles on a treadmill indoors versus walking it outside, it's a really different experience. People actually get better fitness if they're outside, which is kind of hard to explain because you know, it's like the same mileage and the same gradient. But there's just something about maybe like the micro adjustments you make on the trail or the other inputs, you know, maybe kind of change the physiology of how you respond to this movement. And then of course there are these added benefits that you talked about, you know, in terms of feeling a little bit calmer, maybe more creative. People get better ideas, it seems like, when they're outside, because there's kind of this, there's this kind of window of interest and boredom, right? When you're outside. If you're on a treadmill, you're so bored that you're like listening to a podcast or reading a book or watching TV or whatever. But when you're outside, I mean, maybe you're doing those things, but if you're smart, you'll take your headphones out and just like listen to the birds, and maybe you'll see a butterfly and you'll notice, you know, the tree bark or the patterns on a creek or something like that. And it keeps you kind of interested enough that you're not so bored that you're completely, you know, in a different planet, like a podcast. And yet you are still enough bored that your brain can really go 100 miles an hour and start thinking of cool thoughts and, you know, creative connections and things like that. So it's like this weird, special magic zone that you're in when you're walking in nature.
Absolutely. And like I believe you even mentioned in your book, a lot of geniuses have come up with some amazing solutions while they were out walking.
That's right. Nikola Tesla, the Scottish inventor, James Watt, who didn't really invent the steam engine, but he invented a way to make it a completely successful machine when he was outside. Wordsworth, I think, walked something like 10,000 miles in his lifetime and composed poetry while he was walking. Beethoven used to apparently go hug trees. And, you know, it really inspired a lot of his music.
I think part of that is, like you said, there's so much sensory information that you're able to take in outside, that it actually helps you live in your design. And, you know, we're designed to be part of the world also, but we're also designed to move our eyes and our head and take things in. But if you're on a treadmill, you're not. Like you're either looking at the screen or you're hearing the, you just like drowning things out, but your head's usually fixed, or you're like holding your hand. So you're not even, a lot of people don't even move their arms when they're on a treadmill because they're holding on to it. Right. So you're just missing out on all this sensory information that would like pretty much feed your soul. And then you're missing out on the possibility of, are those birds actually singing for you instead of just making noise?
I like that. Well, and in the Nature Folks book too, I talk to physicists who study fractal patterns, which are patterns that repeat at different scales. And they're often found in nature. And we know from studies in labs that when humans look at fractal patterns, it changes their brainwaves. It makes them both sort of calm and alert. It makes them happy. So, you know, if you think about like those screensavers, you know, that have those patterns, that, you know, it's because we get kind of like hypnotized and zoned into them, and we think they're really sort of relaxing and interesting. And the same thing happens when we're outside.
That's really cool. So you mentioned those things can help you become happier. Do you have any advice for somebody that might be going through heartbreak, like some things that they can maybe implement or try to help ease the pain?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Number one is take it seriously, you know, and really try to motivate yourself to get better. Don't just kind of wait it out, because time is of the essence here in terms of your immune cells. I think it's really important to try to get out of a state of fight or flight, you know, that state of threat I talked about. So if you can find a way that makes you feel calm and safe, so whether that's, you know, doing yoga or breath work or exercising or breathing or dancing or listening to music, but try to get to a place where you feel a little bit calmer, because there's no healing that's going to happen if you're in fight or flight. So that's the first piece, is calm. And then the second piece is connection. So really, really make an effort to connect to friends, to family members. You know, make sure you are trying to counteract some of that loneliness, because if you stay too long in a state of loneliness, it's actually a sort of counterintuitively harder to get out of it. You tend to be more suspicious of other people. You tend to feel like there's more threat around you. You become less outgoing, the more inward and sort of, you know, isolated you are. So the connection piece is really important. And by the way, into that equation, I would put connecting to nature, because we also know from some research that people who do spend time around plants and animals and in ecosystems feel more connected to that and also less lonely, which is really interesting. So calm, connect. And then the final piece is really working on a sense of meaning. Like, what can you take from this experience moving forward? What have you learned from it? And how can you take that information and even look beyond yourself so that you can help others? How can this experience make you more empathetic to the suffering of other people? How can you be more open and a better listener and a better friend? All of that, I think, is a real big piece of the puzzle of kind of growing, you know, from this painful experience.
Awesome. That is awesome. Awesome advice. Florence, you've got three great books. I'll be honest. I haven't read the first one because I didn't know if it was applicable to me.
You would like it.
The title makes me think I would like it, but I'm not sure.
There are pictures.
Oh, did you say there's pictures?
But they're funny pictures.
I like funny pictures. So you've got three great books, and are you working on anything new? Do you got another book in the pipeline?
I don't at the moment. I have been working pretty hard on promoting the Heartbreak book and getting that out there. My kids also went off to college this year, and I ended up moving across the country. So I'm getting settled in.
That's a lot of change.
Colorado. Yeah, it's a big change. Yeah. How are you feeling about it now? Are you Feeling better? Are you still missing them? What's going on?
I'm less numb. No, I miss them, especially when things that we would always do or something like that I would usually share with them pops up. I'm like, well, I can't really do that. Like, and this is super silly, but like tomorrow, The Mandalorian on Disney comes out,
I love that.
and my kids and I, we would, as soon as we would come out, no matter what day it was always Wednesday, like, but we would just take off part of the middle of the day and we would hang out and watch it. And it was something we would do together. And I love that. And tomorrow it comes out, and if I do it, it'll be by myself. So.
Well, I hear you, Tim, and I have some advice for you, which is that if your kids will do it, I mean, my son will sometimes FaceTime with me and we'll watch The Mandalorian together.
Oh, that is awesome.
Long distance. It's really fun.
So. That is really awesome, man. Since you're a mother, I'm sure your son will probably, like, they would sit on the couch with me. I don't know that they would FaceTime with me. You've
Oh,
got mother power.
I do. My kids are good on FaceTime, pretty good. Now, I mean, of course, I would like to FaceTime them all the time, and I can't do that. I have to just wait for them to suggest it. But it's really, right? It's really exciting to watch them kind of sprout and
It is.
grow independent. But I get it. It's bittersweet.
It is very bittersweet. One last question for you. Do you like peanut butter?
Love it.
What's your favorite kind?
Gosh, good question. I don't think I'm that picky about what kind of peanut butter. I do prefer crunchy.
Awesome.
And I go crazy for peanut butter with dark chocolate. So sometimes
Oh,
I'll
so
just
good.
make my own kind of peanut butter cup where I'll like break off a chunk of dark chocolate and I'll just scoop up some peanut butter right out of the jar and just eat it like that. And it's like my favorite thing ever.
If you are listening, everyone, you have just heard our best peanut butter answer on the podcast ever. That was awesome.
Right. I'm passionate about my peanut butter.
Florence, where can people buy your books? Is there any place you would like them to go in particular, or your equal opportunity for
Oh,
everywhere?
thank you so much for asking. I would send people just to my website where there are a lot of links, including to my audio work and including to my magazine journalism, stuff like that. And that's easy. It's florencewilliams.com.
Awesome, awesome. We will put that in the notes of the show. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Now get outside and play.